that's a mountain I may have to climb.
Here on my name is Grace Garcia. You are listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota.
From WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, this is Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for Tuesday, July 23rd. The Florida delegation to the next month's Democratic convention in Chicago was quick to endorse Vice President Kamala Harris for president. Yesterday, Florida Party Chair Nikki Fried announced that in less than 24 hours after President Joe Biden stepped back, all except eight of Florida's 254-member delegation signed a letter endorsing Harris. The delegates organized an all-hands-on-deck meeting Sunday evening. They met for about 20 minutes and no other candidate was considered. The process of picking the next Democratic candidate is not clear. No other Democratic presidential candidate has ever withdrawn from the race after securing a nomination. On the ballot this November are the access to abortion and the recreational marijuana amendment. But there are more amendments to the Florida Constitution in the making. A group of healthcare activists is trying to get Medicaid expansion on the ballot of the 2026 midterm elections, and they just got a major financial boost. The political committee that is leading this Medicaid effort has received nearly $500,000 in donations in the first half of July. Half of those recent donations to Florida Decides Healthcare came from a California-based foundation. If the petition gets close to 900,000 signatures, Medicare expansion will make it on the ballot in 2 years. Voters would be asked whether to provide Medicaid coverage to Floridians age 18 to 65 whose income is below or at 138% of the federal poverty level. The Republican-controlled Florida legislature has repeatedly rejected calls to expand eligibility for the public health insurance program. The state has stopped taking new applications for an 18-year-old home hardening program less than a month after nearly $175 million of new funding became available. On its website, the Department of Financial Services said that funding for the My Safe Florida Home program has been exhausted. The legislature funded the program only three times in 2006, 2022, and most recently last year. The web post said that in the next legislative session, the Florida Chief Financial Officer will put forward some ideas for a dedicated funding stream. This has been Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for Tuesday, July 23rd.
You are listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV 100.1 in Bradenton.
This is show 41 of our Changing Environment, and is being recorded on July 23rd. 2024. The previous show was Corduroy, hosted by Alicia, filling in for Sebastian.
I'm Julie Morris.
I'm John O'Miller, and we are assisted today by Alvaro Montalegre.
Our guest today is Brian Walton, the executive director of Save Our Sea Birds in Sarasota. Their mission is rescuing and rehabilitating sick and injured birds with the goal of being able to release them back into their natural habitats. Save Our Sea Birds also have over 100 resident birds who can't be released due to their injuries. Save Our Sea Birds uses the stories of these birds to educate the public about avian conservation.
The views, comments, and opinions that come from our interviews, shows, on-air personalities, and from our calling guests are uncensored, and those views and opinions can be widespread and extremely diverse. The opinions or views expressed by SAME do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of WSLR, our staff, or volunteers.
Brian, it's so great to have you with us today to talk about Save Our Sea Birds, which is the local bird rehabilitation and rescue center for Sarasota and Manatee counties.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here with you. Yes, we serve Sarasota and we serve portions of Manatee. You know, we hope to expand our geographic area in the future, but right now we stop at the county line on the mainland side, and then we go all the way over Anna Maria Island on the coastal side.
Well, that's great. So you catch all the island.
Yes.
All the islands.
You know, it's really dictated by volunteers. You know, all of our rescuers are volunteers. So the geographic area, it's hard to send a volunteer too far out to rescue and then come out to us out on City Island.
So the Wildlife Commission keeps a list of all the licensed wildlife rehabilitators, and they're currently showing one Wildlife Inc. in Bradenton Beach. Are they still functional?
They are. They are. I actually have never. I've only been with Save Our Seabirds since October. So we, you know, Wildlife Inc. is essentially our northern border. Like, so when we get a call from someone who's up in Manatee, we'll refer them to Wildlife Inc.
Okay, and then let's talk about your eastern and southern boundaries.
Yeah, so we go as far eastern as we can, and again, that's really dictated by volunteers. So once we get to the interstate, you know, that kind of becomes, it's hard to get over into Lakewood Ranch. It, you know, we do what we can. Occasionally, we'll have a volunteer. We don't get as many calls from there, so that's, you know, that's the good thing. I mean, most of the calls come from closer to the coast, but we do have a couple of volunteers out that way. You know, we have 85 volunteers total, and what happens is every week they notify us as to their rough approximate availability for the week. So then when we get a call in the office, the team will look at, okay, who's available, and they know where everybody lives, and they kind of know the geographic area they're willing to cover, and we do the best we can. We've got a core staple of folks who will do just about anything, anytime, anywhere, but we're always looking for more volunteers because that's really the key. And you mentioned Wildlife Inc. You know, they've been around a long time. They're a relatively smaller operation in terms of their office and their veterinarian team. This started with a couple, and I haven't had the opportunity to meet them, but I really want to because I've heard wonderful things about them. But we try to be good partners. So, yeah. So with Wildlife Inc., and then we go as far east as we can. And then when we get to the southern part, it's kind of the same thing. You know, there is another organization down in Venice. So we don't, you know, Siesta Key will go a little bit beyond. It's kind of just a gray area, and it's a decision by decision basis.
And so it's not just seabirds.
Correct.
It's any kind of bird that needs to be rescued and rehabilitated.
That's right. Any wild bird in specific. So, mm-hmm. You know, we in our permanent residence, we do have what we call Parrot Row, which is a group of exotics. Mm-hmm. We don't accept parrots anymore or exotics. We stick with wild birds. When we get calls about birds that are pets, there are other organizations that specialize in that and look for rehoming and things, but we've got about a dozen parrots on Parrot Row that have been there longer than any staff members, and you know, they're former pets. People don't realize, you know, that's one of the messages, because when folks come on our campus, that's, we want to educate people about the beauty of the diversity of the wildlife, the birds in specific in our community. I mean, that's part of what makes this place so special is the diversity of birds. And one of the messages when it comes to the parrots, because sometimes people are surprised we have them, and it's, well, you know, people think they want a bird for a pet, but they don't always understand what they're getting into. You know, there's some of those species can live to be like 80 years old. And so you get a bird for a pet, it's going to be in your will sometimes. And they're also extremely loud, and they're pretty high maintenance. So unfortunately, all the parrots on our campus are former pets that people realize they couldn't take care of. And so our staff does everything they can to enhance and you know, just make their life good.
So talk about how someone becomes a volunteer.
Yeah, so they just contact our office. They can go to our website at saveourseabirds.org. They can call our office, and we have a wonderful staff leader there. Her name is Sarah Rubin. She's the director of education and outreach, and she kind of stewards that volunteer team. And so There's an initial application that just essentially just tells us a little bit about you, and then we do an initial interview, and then we try to find a placement. And we have many volunteer opportunities. So in addition to rescuers, and I should say rescuing, there's a variety of roles there. Like sometimes it's as simple as a bird in a box. That's kind of our phrase, you know, that somebody has found a bird, it's in a box, and you don't have to go out with a net or anything. You just go pick up the bird and you transport it to the office. So you go from those simple ones to, we have folks who sometimes rescues involve kayaks and boats, trains, planes, automobiles, you know, whatever it takes to catch that bird. And so it can be net captures and all kinds of things. So we kind of run the gamut of the rescues. And then we also have volunteer roles. Like we have people who come in and answer the phones and help with dispatching of volunteers. We have what we call docents, because we kind of think of our Wild Bird Learning Center, it's in many ways like a living museum. And so we have folks who are trained to give tours on campus or just welcome folks. There's just lots of different opportunities, including grounds and maintenance. Not as many. One thing I do want to say, sometimes we get people who want to be really hands-on with the birds in the hospital and such, and there's not many volunteer roles for that. As the years have gone by, we're governed, licensed, and inspected and follow the rules of many, many government organizations in Florida, including Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and also the USDA, which was a new one this year. So it's birds are very easily imprinted. That means that they develop an attachment and they start thinking that they're human and they start being drawn to humans. And when it comes to the hospital, that's the last thing we want. You know, we want, these are wild birds. We want them to stay wild and we want them to stay away from humans when they leave, because most of the birds who come to us, they come because of encounters with humans. So we don't want to encourage that.
So this may be a good time to read something from the Florida Wildlife Commission, and it says, this is from their website, injured, orphaned, or abandoned native animals are never eligible to be kept as personal pets in Florida. Personal pet permits are only issued for animals which are obtained from a legal source. Any injured, orphaned, or abandoned native animals must be brought to a permitted wildlife rehabilitator for rehabilitation, caring for sick, injured, or often orphaned native wildlife beyond the time necessary to transport the animal to a permitted rehabilitator is against the law.
Yeah. That's, I appreciate you reading that. So we kind of keep track of our calls and things, and we like to say we get about 5,000 calls a year. But we only bring about 1,200 birds a year into the office, because a lot of those calls, we ask a lot of questions, because people will see, especially this time of year, you know, in the spring into the summer, people will find a baby bird on the ground and they'll just decide to take it. And you know, we have to ask a lot of questions, or they'll find a nest. And, you know, in most cases, you're not allowed to disturb a nest, and even if it's inconvenient for you. And so we do a lot of triage on the phone, and sometimes it's trying to convince people, don't steal those baby birds, leave them where they are. You know, it's we got a call this week from someone who had taken birds in, meant well, had been force feeding the birds bread for a couple of days, and, you know, had the best of intentions, but just didn't have the expertise that were necessary. So yeah, if ever in doubt, we encourage people to call. Our staff and our volunteers on the phones are very experienced. And sometimes people don't understand, they'll call us about a bird and we'll ask for photos and videos. And I think sometimes people get irritated. They're like, no, just send someone. Well, you know, we need to learn a little bit more about the situation before we send a volunteer out. Or they'll say, I saw a bird as I was driving down the road. It looked like something was wrong. But so we pretty much, you know, unfortunately, with the limited resources, you know, we'll ask a lot of questions. We get pictures and video. We show them to the veterinarian, and then they'll make a decision about whether we go. And if eyes aren't on the bird, there's no guarantee that bird's going to be there when somebody gets there. But yeah, there's a lot of rules with the Migratory Bird Act and other things. People need to be very cautious about what they do interfering with wildlife. Sometimes we do more harm than good, even though our intentions are the best.
So there's an interesting bird rescue anecdote from FWC. There was a guy in the Lakeland office of the Wildlife Commission, and it's like 10 till 5. He's ready to go home. He gets a call from this woman who says, I've got a bald eagle in a cardboard box. Mm. And he said, well, are you sure it's a bald? Could you describe this bird to me? She said, it's a big bird, has a white head, black wings, and a white tail. And I've got it here, but I don't know what, you know, what to do with it. And he said, all right, it's like a 45-minute drive, but I'll head out there. If you got a bald eagle, it's, you know, definitely sure. worth my time. So he drives out there, and he gets there, and the woman opens the door and says, I have some bad news. And he said, what's that? She said, well, the eagle got out of the box, but it's still in my lanai. It's still contained. So they go out on the lanai, and here's a pigeon with a white head, a white tail, and a black wings and black body. So looked like a bald eagle, just scaled down a little.
Well, that's a great example of why we ask for pictures and video, right? Yeah. Because sometimes what folks describe or what they think they're seeing is not actually what they're seeing, and so that process is very helpful to us. And you can imagine, I mean, we get all kinds of calls from all kinds of people, and that's the 5,000 calls down to 1,200 rescues is because a lot of the situations can be mitigated, and it's better for us to just stay out of the situation.
So if someone has a mockingbird nest in a bush by their front door and the mockingbird is like dive bombing them every time they go in and out, they can't, it's against the law for them to try to relocate that nest, and they shouldn't be calling you about that.
Well, you know, they can certainly call us, and like some of our staff, and this would be a good point for you, for me to just tell you a little bit about myself and to tell your listeners a little bit about myself. So I came to Save Our Seabirds in October, and at the time, and this was literally what I told the board in my second interview, I said, I can't tell the difference between an anhinga and a cormorant. Like, I really didn't have the background. I've learned a lot since October, but I don't position myself in any way, shape, or form as an avian expert. Again, I've learned a ton since I've been here, and I can tell the difference between a cormorant and an anhinga now. But we have staff that have extensive backgrounds, and our senior hospital tech, Jonathan Hand, our veterinarian who's on our staff, Maria Passarelli. We have people who know their stuff. And so, you know, if people need a little bit of advice of what to do or what are the rules or the laws, they call in. They're generally not going to get me on the phone, but they're going to get someone who's going to answer their questions, because we do want to serve the public and help people. You know, how do we... No, the issue with the declining bird population in North America, and it is declining severely over the last 50 years, the issue is primarily encounters between human beings and wildlife. And so if we can help people figure out how to live, to coexist with that mockingbird, we certainly want to do that. And so we give the best advice we can in all those situations. But I give that disclaimer about myself because inevitably you're going to say something today, and I'm going to say something that one of your listeners is going to say, he doesn't have a clue what he's talking about. My background has been in nonprofit management. I've managed and led nonprofits and fundraising since I was 20 years old, so for 30 years. So we have a lot of plans for expansion and redevelopment at Save Our Seabirds, and the board felt like that, you know, we had the bird experts on staff. We needed a little bit more organizational approach to our organization to plan for the future and to scale up.
So you may not have been there long enough to be able to answer this, but I'm just curious. If 1,200 birds come into your facility a year, some don't make it.
Sure.
Some are rehabilitated but are not eligible to be released to the wild.
Right.
And then some are successfully released. So do you just have rough proportions of how that plays out?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, in any industry and whenever we start talking statistics, you know, you always have to ask a lot of questions about people's statistics, because I heard a long time ago 86.35% of all statistics are made up on the spot. Yeah. And that's just to say that, you know, depending upon where you start and where you end, statistics can say different things. Birds are very fragile creatures. And the reality is no birds come to our facility because they're healthy. You know, baby bird season, for instance, you know, nature can be a very cruel place, and sometimes that baby bird that you find that's isolated and by itself, there was a decision made in the nest that, you know, there's only so much food to go around, and this bird had something wrong with it, and the mom knows that. Like, they have just an innate sense. And so, unfortunately, sometimes that bird, you know, that was a process of natural selection going on, and that bird was not selected for feeding, and that's hard for people to understand. So when that bird comes to us, you know, it's already kind of disadvantaged. And same thing, because birds are so fragile in general, when they come to us, a lot of birds, and this is across the board at every rehab facility, the first 24 hours, the survivability rate is pretty low of birds. You know, in our statistics, we count even those, if they show up at our facility, it counts in our numbers, regardless of whether it was dead on arrival or whatever it might be. And that's the right way to do the statistics. You know, sometimes when you hear statistics of hospitals and things, they don't include those. So I actually can't recall precisely what that number is for us, the first 24 hours, but it's relatively low. If you go past the first 24 hours, so you get past the ones that are just in really terrible condition when they show up, get past the DOAs, all of that, our survivability jumps more to like 60% after the first 24 hours. And so that's, you know, that first 24 hours is critical. Decisions are made early on because the veterinarian is not going to let a bird suffer, you know, if it's clearly not treatable. But we have the facilities that we can, if that bird is has a chance, we're going to do everything we can. You know, they do diagnosis. I'll tell you a quick story. My first week here, I shadowed in the hospital. Obviously, that I needed to do that. I needed to see what this work was all about. And a red-tailed hawk came in that day. And it was the coolest thing in the world. Like, I'd never been that close to such a magnificent creature before. And he was completely lethargic, like just completely lifeless, no movement at all. Staff was all gloved up because, you know, those birds got some pretty big talons. But the bird never responded to anything. And I thought, wow, this guy clearly isn't going to make it. And Dr. Passarelli did blood tests right there in the office, and she determined that he had an iron deficiency, and through a series of examinations, did a full body exam and concluded that most likely he had been a victim of a rodenticide, of accidental poisoning. People don't understand this in the public, but you have some kind of a rodent nuisance and you put out poisons. Most of the traditional rodenticides, they're basically an anti-blood clotting, and they don't cause immediate death. And that rodent becomes slow, lethargic. Well, guess who the bird catches? Like, the bird catches the slow, lethargic rodent and then takes it back to its nest and poisons the whole family, essentially. That's a big problem with the raptors. And so Dr. Passarelli identified it, diagnosed this bird, treated it, started giving it vitamin K, I believe, and started giving it fluids and flushing out the system. And like 19 days later, she came to me and she said, "Hey, you remember that bird?" I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Well, he's ready to go. He's ready to be released." So he was with us for almost 3 weeks. And then I got to take him out. And so our policy is we try to release the bird as close to where they came from as we can. And so I got to take him to, I believe it's called South Water Tower Park, down off Tamiami. And I tell you, people disagree some about, you know, what are the skills and abilities and senses of a bird, but this bird did not move the entire time he was in the box. Like, I put him in my car, no movement at all. I drove to Water Tower Park. When I opened the door at Water Tower Park, it was like there was a jumping bean in that box. That box was bouncing up and down. It was like he knew that he was home. And I took him out and I opened the box, and that guy just soared out of that box and sailed across the park. And there's actually a video on our website. You can go and watch this, but if you look really closely, it's easy to miss, but there was a squirrel out in the middle of that field who was not expecting to see a hawk come out of a cardboard box. And that guy bolted for the tree And if that hawk hadn't been so determined to get away from me, he would have had lunch right there on the spot. But the little guy made it up the tree, and the hawk went on to live a happy life. And that hooked me. I knew then that, wow, this is, I understand what we do. This is good. We may not make a difference for all of them, but we made a difference for that one.
So since you opened the topic of rodenticides and the illness or the sickness that resulted in for the red-tailed hawk, what are the other kinds of human interactions that cause harm to birds, wild birds?
Here? Yeah, okay, that's a great question. So I think the most common things that we see are strikes. So you have boat strikes, you have car strikes, you have strikes with windows. You know, birds confuse clear windows for a safe passage. Fishing line and lures, people leaving their fishing line. We had a bird come in. It was another hawk, actually. He was wrapped in like 100 yards, 200 yards of fishing line. Like it's just obscene. So hooks, fishing line and lures, it's the proximity of, we are in their turf, you know, we're in their space. It's loss of habitat. It's invasive species. I can't recall off the top of my head the number of birds killed by cats every year. If you look that up, it is just massive. And most of those are feral cats, but they're also outdoor cats. You know, we just need to be aware that, you know, we introduce things into the environment. And I'm not saying don't have cats. I think cats are wonderful. But feral cats in specific are responsible for like 60% of the, it's like 2 billion bird. It's some crazy number that, you know, they're very skilled hunters. So, and then pollution in general, you know, I think the statistic is like 80 to 90% of birds have microplastics in their bodies. Like we don't understand that, you know. Some species of bird we continue to see like after a red tide event, and humans don't cause red tide events necessarily, but we certainly are capable of making it worse. There was just a study, I read a study by Dr. Tomasco with the Sarasota Bay Estuary Program. He just had a study on LinkedIn and talked about that, you know, red tides are a naturally occurring event, but our pollution can definitely make them worse. And then just the loss of or climate change itself, you know, migratory patterns have changed due to, and I know that can be a, you know, that's become a politically charged issue with people, but most people I know don't, even the most conservative person wouldn't necessarily say climate change isn't a real thing. They just maybe disagree on how or why or what to do about it. But the reality is the changing temperature patterns are changing migratory patterns, and birds are staying in places where they shouldn't be longer, and it's affecting birthing. So, I was reading, I've obviously my learning curve has been high since October. And I was reading that in the last 50 years, so essentially in my lifetime, we've lost 30% of our bird population in North America. It's declined by 30%. And they have identified like 70 species that are considered turning point species that are expected to decline another 50%. Now, I don't care who you are, but if you just pause and think about that, my kids are very much into like sci-fi and dystopian novels. They're nerds. They read a lot. And, you know, there is a theme that comes up often in that kind of literature, which is people go outside and there are no bird sounds. Like if you can just imagine that, you know, you don't hear an owl hooting at night, you don't hear songbirds in the morning, you go to the beach and you don't hear any gulls. Like it's just quiet. And I don't think any of us want that.
Well, we've noticed it just where we live. We used to get chuckwheel's widows would migrate through, and we haven't heard one of those.
They were actually summer residents. The chuckwheel's widows were summer residents. Whippoorwills would migrate through.
Well, they were migratory.
Yeah.
They just weren't going through, is your point.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
So, we used to get chuckwheel's widows, and we don't hear them calling anymore.
Mm.
Yeah.
So, you know, something that I've noticed is you go on YouTube, and you'll see these compassionate heartwarming stories of this coyote got caught in a barbed wire fence and somebody cut it out, and this animal fell in a ditch and couldn't climb up over the sides, or these poor ducklings couldn't follow their mother. And I'm thinking, well, yeah, it's great that people helped out, but all of these are situations that were initially created by people.
Right.
And I remember we used to go, before the Legacy Trail existed, we would go to Oscar Scheer, and there were the old railroad tracks, and these baby gopher, small gopher tortoises would get over one rail, but not have the oomph to get over the other rail. Mm-hmm. And they would just sort of ping pong back and forth between these two rails until they died of heat exhaustion. So something as small as a curb or a railroad rail, these are reptiles, but they're comparable situations for birds. Things that people do that they're just completely unaware that it's going to cause a problem for wildlife.
Absolutely, and I think that's one of our messages, right? So if you think of a two-pronged approach for us, we have the hospital where we do rehab and release, and then we have the Wild Bird Learning Center that's open every day, and we have these 100 birds that live there. And part of the message there is just simply, we want people to grow in their appreciation for these beautiful creatures. And we want people to start to understand that, you know, none of these birds come to our hospital because of a sore throat. You know, they don't come, almost all of them come because of an encounter with a human being.
You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota, and WBPV 100.1 in Bradenton. And perhaps you've heard that as a listener of support of WSLR in Fogartyville, you may be aware of the recent news that the Sarasota County Commission has cut funding to WSLR in Fogartyville from the Tourist Development Cultural Grant recommended by the Arts and Cultural Alliance of Sarasota County. This decision limits our ability to continue bringing world-class talent to the best listening room in Sarasota. Devastating, to quote Jesse Coleman, general manager of WSLR and Fogartyville. This cut in funding wasn't due to not meeting the committee's criteria or due to the quality of offerings available at Fogartyville. 66 performers last year alone, but it was purely a political decision as WSLR and the two other local nonprofits who lost their funding stand for the inclusion of diverse perspectives in our community. We promote democracy and understanding with economic and social justice. Now more than ever, WSLR in Fogartyville could use your help. Be a conscientious voter. Participate in your community, write a letter of support to your commissioners, visit our website, wslr.org, where you will find a draft email you can send, along with more information about how you can contribute. You will no doubt be hearing more about this in the days and weeks to come.
So, Brian, we've gotten halfway through the show, and I don't think we've told our listeners where you're located and what other things people might do in that vicinity when they come visit you.
Sure. We're located on City Island. It's actually part of Ken Thompson Park. So it's 1708 Ken Thompson Parkway. So we're located in the same area as where Moat is presently located. We're actually located between their two facilities. And as I was saying, we have a two-pronged approach. We have the hospital and the rehab facilities, and those facilities are not open to the public. So, as I said earlier, we're governed and licensed by several state and federal organizations, and the rules are that if a bird is a wild bird and releasable, potentially releasable, we cannot have that bird visible to the public at all. So when you come on our campus, you'll never see any of the birds that are being rehabbed or in the hospital. Hospital's not open to the public. And on any given day, there's between 100 and 200 birds. Like, I think I heard we've brought in 60 baby birds this month, and the small baby bird room sometimes has as many as 50 birds in there, if you can imagine that. And they're being fed like every 2 hours throughout the day. And they told me that actually we've been able to staff up due to some good financial support. We've been able to staff up in the hospital recently, and the veterinarian was just telling me yesterday that all the birds in the baby bird room are gaining weight every day, which is a big success because that takes constant care and tending. So the hospital part, 100 to 200 birds are there at any given day. And then we have what we call the Wild Bird Learning Center. And the Wild Bird Learning Center is open 365 days a year because our staff is there taking care of birds daily, regardless of what holiday it is. So the Wild Bird Learning Center is open every day, including holidays, Christmas, Thanksgiving, Easter, everything, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., and admission is completely free. So I would encourage people, and especially if you're one of those out there who's saying, birds are everywhere, the scientists are telling us through their best studies that we are losing, our bird population is declining in pretty large measure. If you're one of those people who aren't really sure what you think about birds or if you care, come to our Wild Bird Learning Center and just take a stroll. It's a beautiful, luscious green campus. It's peaceful. There's some fountains. It's beautiful flora and fauna. Just come in and just take in the scene and just go through. Check out the birds. There's about 80 species on display: owls, hawks, caracara, vultures. There's just any number of things. Of course, pelicans. Just come and see what's there. And I think most people, when they really take it in, our goal is that we would grow an appreciation for this beautiful diversity that's around us in our environment, and that hopefully you pick up a message or two that just says, what can you do to just mitigate this issue of these human encounters with birds? We're not asking people to give up their quality of life, just to be mindful that what we do has an impact, and just to be more careful. So come visit, and it's a very nice day, nice stroll, very relaxing, and I think people will grow in their appreciation for the beauty of our nature around us.
So I'd like to go back. So first of all, am I correct that in addition to having volunteers, that after this triage and phone conversation and exchange mm-hmm. of photos, they'll go out and pick things up, but you also have like a night drop-off facility?
We do. So obviously we can't be open 24/7. Our staff likes to go home occasionally, and so we can receive birds pretty much. So we answer the phones from 8:30 to 4:30, and then if you call after 4:30, you'll get a voicemail, and it'll give you some different instructions of possibilities of what you can do with that bird until morning. And we do have drop-off boxes. They are on the back side of our property. So the you know, depending on which map app you use, you know how that is. It takes you to different places. So if you're coming to the Wild Bird Learning Center, you essentially go to Moat, park in that parking lot, and you go in our front entrance. But if you're bringing a bird, you actually go past that parking lot, and then you go around behind where there's some boat ramps back there, and we've got the hospital entrance back there, and there are drop-off boxes there.
So when staff get there in the morning and they look in the box, if there's a bat or a bunny or a gopher tortoise that's been hit, what becomes of them?
So that's a great question. I was actually just looking at our statistics because we do exclusively treat birds. However, I saw in our numbers from last year that there were a couple of other animals. And I would say that was 100% because they came in the morning and it was in the box. Yeah. And obviously our staff, and that's something I just want to say just for the opportunity, we have the full-time equivalent of 14 people. That counts maintenance, grounds, keepers that care, you know, and then hospital staff and office staff and myself. And our staff are just complete true believers and bird lovers. One of the things you'll hear on our campus all of the time is, what's going to be best for the bird? And this is routine, whether it's one of our maintenance guys or it's our veterinarian, it's what's best for the bird. So they love animals. So they're obviously, if they open that box in the morning, they're going to treat whatever's there. But then we look to find a place to take it, whether it's another veterinarian or a hospital or, you know, whatever the case may be.
Okay.
So talk a little bit more about the boat strikes.
Yeah, so it can be, I mean, it can just be as simple as an impact. You know, the these birds, the cormorants, the anhingas that spend a lot of time in the water, propellers. It's just an impact. Sometimes it's just a blunt force. The boat just hits the bird because it's swimming. Sometimes they get caught up in the propellers, it can be anything from a blunt force trauma to an actual cut, laceration of some kind. And some of these birds, you know, it's a real tricky thing to catch them because they're injured, but they were injured by us and they don't really want to encounter us again. And so I've seen some videos of some pretty heroic efforts where folks are out there in boats with nets and they're, you know, unfortunately, sometimes we have to wait for that bird to get a little worse shape before we can catch it, you know, because if it's a flighted bird, then obviously they fly away. And if they're a swimming bird, they tend to stay really close to that water. But our staff will go, our volunteers will go. And that's obviously, you know, we talked a while ago about the levels of rescue. So when we have some of those, we have to be more choosy about who we're sending out. It's got to be somebody who's more experienced and willing to take an adventure. And we definitely have some of those. Some of those guys are like, I don't want to go do a bird in a box. Send me on the hard ones. And they just go problem solve.
So we also saw on your website that some of the birds that come to you are injured by golf balls.
Yeah, I didn't mention that. You know, it seems extraordinary because I'm a terrible golfer and haven't golfed in a long time, but not everybody is, you know, and you would think that the odds of a golf ball hitting a bird in flight wouldn't be that high, but that is actually far more common than what you would expect. And a golf ball hit at pretty good velocity does a lot of damage to a bird. That is a thing that happens for sure.
I would imagine that's mostly sandhill cranes, wouldn't you, too?
It definitely is sandhill cranes, but it does happen to others. Uh-huh. I've heard stories of pelicans. I've heard stories of other flighted birds that just and I don't know. You know, I've never actually seen it happen firsthand. I don't know if the bird is going for the ball or if it just is that fate thing but it does happen to a variety.
And more commonly now I'm seeing these things on posts near where people are fishing for them to put their fishing line,
right?
Dispose of their fishing line.
Yeah.
And so talk about the interaction of birds and fishermen.
Yeah, well, you know, there are certain places where it's a bigger problem than others. I think birds, and we're often talking about pelicans when it comes to birds and fishermen, and pelicans can be a real nuisance to fishermen. You know, they're coming up, they're trying to get the fish, especially if you're cleaning the fish. I mean, they know you have bait and they're trying to get it. And that's why, you know, there's a general rule of, you know, generally speaking, feeding birds isn't good, regardless of what you're feeding them, because you're only encouraging this nuisance behavior. And you know, the birds, I mean, there's a sense where they're going to go wherever they can find the food the easiest. And the closer that the birds are with fishermen, the more likely there is going to be a negative encounter. And I can't really speak to the whys of it, but it seems like a lot of fishing line and lures are just left for whatever comes next. And these birds, they get hooked, they get wrapped in that line, they try to get out, it gets worse depending upon how long it is. Then they go, if they go to a tree, then they get, I mean, we've seen so many terrible situations where birds are hanging in trees and they can't get themselves freed, or they're, you know, stuck in the water somewhere and they can't get out. People just really need to be mindful of, just because it's convenient for you, maybe you got your hook stuck somewhere and you just cut the line and leave it. Well, you've pretty much signed the death warrant for a bird at some point in time. I mean, it's just guaranteed. So I think fishing is great. I'm an advocate. I grew up doing it. I think it's a wonderful thing. We'd never want to be sounding at all like we're anti-fishermen or anti-fishing. But we just wish people would just make the effort to leave zero footprint behind.
So I wanted to go back for a second and just talk about pelicans, because I think some of our listeners that have been around remember Dale Shields, the Pelican Man.
That's right.
And Dale Shields was a sort of charismatic personality. He was sort of, he had a lot of volunteers, but he was also opinionated and alienated some folks. But he initially, his reputation was, you know, based on pelicans.
Absolutely.
To start with. And and then after he died, my recollection, you can correct me if you know, after he died, the facility there sort of fell on hard times for a couple of years until it was restarted. Is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I only know Dale Shields by reputation, of course, but, you know, what you said of him matches exactly what I've learned of him through things I've read. And my impression is that the Pelican Man Sanctuary back then, which, hey, let's give credit where credit's due. You know, most of the facilities that we're using today are because Dale created them,
right,
including the enclosures and everything. And Pelican Man Sanctuary grew quite large. That at one time he was treating much more than just birds,
right,
and it was a pretty influential center. My impression from what I've seen of the history is Dale was very charismatic. He kind of drew people to himself. It was kind of a following. When he passed away, you know, they tried to keep going with the organization, but I think there was a lot that was just built upon Dale's personality, and they just couldn't keep it running. And they fell on hard times, closed down completely in 2003, I believe. I don't remember exactly what year Dale passed, but it was a couple years after his passing. And then in 2006, the facility was opened back up. One of our board members presently was one of the founding members who financially supported it to open back up. The city required them to raise a bunch of funds to show that they were capable of supporting it. And I've seen some photos from back then. You know, Florida is very capable of reclaiming land back to itself very quickly. And that in that couple of years, the facility really fell in disarray. But they cleaned it up, and we've continued to build upon that even today.
So I want to let people know that Fogartyville presents critically acclaimed Canadian jazz singer and arranger Emily Claire Barlow on Saturday, August 3rd at 8 p.m. A two-time Juno Award winner and six-time nominee, Barlow has released 12 self-produced albums on her own label. She's touring in support of her brand-new album, Spark Bird. So here's a bird connection. For more information and tickets to the August 3rd Emily Claire Barlow concert, visit WSLR.org or call 941-894-6469. That's 941-894-6469. So, Brian, I want to go back, just personally, I'd like to understand. It's clear that you don't accept pets. So if somebody shows up with a chicken, that's not happening.
We actually got a call about a chicken a while back. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. So then the next category would be animals that are domestic animals, but they're not actually pets. They're roaming wild. So, for instance, our neighborhood, we have peacocks.
Mm.
Well, they're not. Nobody, people may feed them, but they don't own them. So,
right.
So you have this category of animals that are domestic animals, like Muscovy ducks. You go to a pond,
right,
and there'll be these Muscovy ducks. They don't really belong to anyone. They could get injured. And then you have the next category is wild animals that are not native. So
right.
You've got your, what are now, what they're called, what are house sparrows called now? English sparrows are house sparrows,
yeah,
right? They're
yeah,
the same.
Yeah.
What are some of our Eurasian collared doves?
Mm-hmm.
Starlings.
Mm-hmm.
And whistling ducks.
Okay, so when, are all
right
of these welcome, or where do you draw the line?
Yeah, well, so you're going to get me in some territory that some of your listeners might be uncomfortable with, but I'll remind everyone that we are governed and controlled. We are licensed and approved by government agencies, and like it or not, we have to abide by their rules, because if we don't, we get shut down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the way it works. So you essentially mentioned birds that fall into three categories. You have native, you have non-native, and then you have invasive. And so, you know, native birds are birds that obviously occur here in the wild naturally. And, you know, I read recently where Florida Fish and Wildlife says that there are 500 commonly occurring species of birds in Florida, like that you would expect to find and see. And I saw in the last 10 years, according to our data, we've treated 307 of those species. Wow. So, yeah, I thought that was pretty cool. So you have native birds that you would expect to see here. Then you have non-native. And non-native can be due to migration or different things, but you have non-native birds, and there's no issue with us treating and releasing native and non-native birds. When you get into invasives, these are birds that the powers that be have decided that they are invasive species that don't naturally occur here that have been introduced and are displacing native birds because there's only so many resources to go all around. So we are not legally allowed to release invasive species. So this is, you know, this is where it becomes, you know, so we have a facility. So on our Wild Bird Learning Center, you will see both native, non-native, and invasive species. We have Mama Muscovy is a Muscovy duck. She is on display. She is there. That is her permanent home, and she'll be there. We're not allowed to release Mama back into the wild. And we have several of those cases where they are on exhibit. So what happens, honestly, if somebody calls our staff, part of that process on the phone, you know, part of the discovery is one of the reasons we want to get a picture is what kind of bird is it? And remember, all of our staff are bird lovers. And we want to see the condition of that bird. And if the staff determines that that's an invasive species bird, and it's not suffering terribly, then many times we'll say, you know, it would probably be best if you just let that bird be because we don't have a place for it on campus and we're not allowed to release it.
Got it.
Yeah.
So the other problem, and I think this may have happened at other wildlife centers, I'm not sure, but for instance, laughing gulls get messed up with fishing line, mm-hmm, and lose a wing. Mm-hmm. Well, if you only had 5 laughing gulls a year that lost a wing and couldn't be released, after 20 years, you'd be feeding 100 laughing gulls.
Right.
So do you end up in a situation where you simply can't sustain the number of unreleasable native birds?
I thought I did a good job of avoiding that question. Well, you're going to make me go there.
That's why we're a hard-hitting radio show.
Yeah, so we do have an approved euthanasia policy that, you know, that kind of has a step-by-step checklist, and only our hospital staff and specifically our veterinarian can make that call. But if we have no other alternatives, you know, if a bird comes in and is suffering terribly and the prognosis is not good, then, you know, you go through that list and euthanasia becomes a very real possibility. And there are cases, I thought I very skillfully avoided
it. You tried, you were great.
When I said, you know, we encourage people not to bring in the invasive species unless it's really suffering. You know, obviously we don't want a bird to, but if it's just hobbled a little bit, then it's probably better to just let it make its way in nature. Because if that bird comes in and it's invasive, and if we don't have a place for it, because that's what people don't understand. And I will say, you know, our website used to say that we have a permanent home for those birds that can't be released. But I didn't like that wording because it has an implication that if you just think of 5, 10, 20 years down the road, how could we possibly have room? Yeah. And so, yes, there is a euthanasia protocol that we have to humanely euthanize some of those birds. We try every other alternative, but it does become a reality in some cases.
So I want to point out that you also have summer camps, and you have 2 events coming up in early August, including a night hike,
yes,
and an owl pellet dissection,
yes,
and that you also have internships for college students in the Avian Hospital.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So I encourage people to check out our website and Facebook page regularly. Sarah Rubin, who I mentioned early, Director of Outreach and Education, she's all the time doing events where some of those events are free. Like, for instance, every day at noon, we do Pelican Feeding Frenzy. And the keeper staff go out there, they feed the pelicans by hand, and someone just gives a short talk about the pelicans. But we routinely do all kinds of events throughout the week. We try to post those on Facebook and the website. And the ones you mentioned, the owl pellet dissection, I think is $5 or $10 to be a part of, because we do have our own owl pellets, but they're not... how should you say, they're, you know, our owls have different diets in captivity
than
what an owl.
That's
so
right.
So we purchase the pellets because they're, I'm trying to think of the word, disinfected. They're, you know, they're clean.
Uh-huh.
As clean as an owl pellet can be, I guess. Mm-hmm. And then, but though that's a very interesting, fascinating exercise. And then the night hike, I think, is a little bit, we also every Sunday in partnership with Longboat Key Club and Resort, we do a beach walk. Sarah does a beach walk, and just they go through the beach and comb the shoreline and the different, you know, and just talk about what's going on out there. And there's usually some sort of a conservation message. So yeah, education is a big part of what we do. You know, it's not just about treating and releasing the birds, but it's about trying to do some education and prevention work with those things.
I wanted to ask, sometimes you probably get a listed species of bird coming in, and are there extra hurdles that you have to do in order to treat and release those listed species, like black skimmers or lease terns?
That's a great question. And there are different protocols with Fish and Wildlife Commission. We have Officer Bob. He's our man, and we communicate with Officer Bob. For instance, eagles. We had two eagles come in earlier in the season, and that's always exciting. And these particular two, the only thing I can gather that must have happened is they were fighting over territory, and they collided in midair, and they became fused together. Their talons were stuck inside each other, and they fell to the ground, and they were found in someone's yard, literally still, like, one talon was in the other's eye, and they came into the hospital that way. We have to make those calls, notify that we have, you know, a special case bird, and then, you know, they're very interested in what happens with that bird at that point. And sometimes we're involved with out on Lido, you know, there's a skimmer colony out there.
Yeah, that's right.
And, you know, there's an interesting thing going on out there. We had a lady very upset call because Fish and Wildlife have actually put crow effigies out there. Because the crows were eating all the eggs of the skimmers, and the skimmers are, you know, a special case bird. And so they've actually put crow effigies, dead crows, around there to signal to the other crows that this is not a good place to be. And it works. Like, it's a last case scenario. And this lady was very upset with us. We said, we didn't do it. Here's the number you need to call. Like, we don't have anything to do with that. But they're, you know, the crows are abundant, and they're very aggressive with those special case.
And they're smart. And
they're
very smart.
When
they see a dead crow,
that's right.
They say this is, and the same thing works for vultures, interestingly enough.
Yeah, vultures are very smart as well. Those are two of the things I've learned since being here that I had no idea about.
Yeah, I can't imagine your learning curve. Where were you living prior to Florida?
Well, I've been in Florida for about 11, 12 years.
Oh,
I was on the
okay.
East Coast, okay. So I was in the Daytona Beach area.
All right. We got some crazy birds here, and that's something people notice. They move in, and all of a sudden there's a great egret in their front lawn, and they've never seen anything like it.
Yeah.
Or flocks of white ibis probing in,
right, in
probing
their lawn.
For,
yeah.
In the lawn, right. Yeah,
yeah.
So it's... it's a very high bird interaction.
Absolutely.
Residential area.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess some of the lease terns are switching to nesting on roofs, on flat roofs, mm-hmm. which may be a good or a bad choice for them. And I think the shorebird nesting areas will be... the, you know, sea level's rising, the beaches are going to be retreating, and so that's a habitat loss thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. You've been listening to Our Changing Environment on listener-sponsored WSLR LP Radio 96.5 FM, broadcasting from our downtown Sarasota studios on Kumquat Court.
What about WBPV?
Yeah, that's right. WBPV 100.1 in Bradenton.
Today's show, number 41, featured Brian Walton exploring Save Our Seabirds facility here in Sarasota.
Previous shows of Our Changing Environment may be accessed at the WSLR archives. Go to archive.wslr.org.
If you'd like to be notified about upcoming shows, you can join the Facebook group, Our Changing Environment.
And tune in at 9 a.m. 2 weeks from today on August 6th for another episode of Our Changing Environment.
On July 30th, this time slot will be the Healthy Living Hour, hosted by Rebecca Acosta.
If you're interested in local public affairs, tune in every Thursday at 9 a.m. for The Detail, hosted by Kathy Antunes.
And don't forget to check out the live music, public affairs, and other special events at Fogartyville on Lemon Lane, just 6 blocks north of Main Street, here in Sarasota.
Right now, stay tuned for Amy